חיילים אלמונים מיננו בלי מדים וסביבנו אמה.
In May of 1981, Prime Minister Menachem Begin was visited in his office by a group of American Jews who asked him what he thought were the lessons of the Holocaust. Begin immediately responded with a lengthy reflection. The lessons for Begin included these. Begin said, "If an enemy of our people says he seeks to destroy us, believe him. Don't doubt him for a moment. Don't make light of it. Do all in your power to deny him the means of carrying out his satanic intent." Begin further said, "When a Jew anywhere is threatened or under attack, do all in your power to come to his aid. Never pause to wonder what the world will think or say." The world, Begin added, may not necessarily like the fighting Jew, but the world will have to take account of him. Of course, as these Americans stood there in Begin's office, listening to him speak about the lessons of the Holocaust, they had no idea that he was planning a strike on the Iraqi nuclear reactor at Osirak. And what he, Begin, was communicating to them was his own mindset, his thought process, as to why for the last many months he had been working on an operation that for him was unquestionably necessary, an operation that for the rest of the world was largely utterly unthinkable. It's often said that the Begin doctrine is never allow an enemy nation to attain nuclear capacity. But actually, that's just the ramification of the Begin doctrine. The true Begin doctrine is this: if any of our people says he seeks to destroy us, don't doubt him for a moment. And when a Jew is threatened, do everything in your power to help him. That is the doctrine that drove Begin to strike Osirak. And this was not a doctrine that Begin developed in office. It was a doctrine that he had put to writing many decades before. In 1951, when, entirely out of power, he decided to write his memoir, The Revolt, describing the rebellion against the British that he launched in 1944, and more importantly, the philosophy and mindset behind that rebellion. Menachem Begin's strike on Osirak was so shocking when it occurred to Israelis that when the Prime Minister's office called the Israeli media to inform them that it had occurred, they thought it was a prank phone call. But if the media had just read Menachem Begin's book, then the announcement of the strike would not have been a surprise. There's a famous line from the film Patton, when the general anticipates everything that his foe, General Rommel, will do. And then, in the well-known scene, Patton, and I'm cleaning this up a tiny bit, Patton says something like, "Rommel, I read your book." It is perhaps the most famous line in the film. And because of my interest in the movie, which we'll discuss in a separate talk, I wondered whether Patton had ever actually said it. The answer, I discovered, is to be found in a talk given by the military historian Christopher Nelson, who said that, quote, "Interestingly enough, that was an ad-libbed line in the movie." And he added, "George C. Scott actually made up that line. It was one of the most iconic lines in the movie, but it was basically fabricated on the spot." Having said that, he continued, Patton did read the book, Patton did read Infantry Attacks by Rommel. He also read many of the other German writers. In the exact morally opposite way, if we wish to understand why Begin did what he did, why he lived the way he lived, we need to read not the book of the enemy, but the book of my hero. We need to read his book. And if you read Begin's book, nothing that Begin did, not even make peace with Egypt, would be a surprise. To read The Revolt is to commune with Begin's mind and to encounter his soul, which is why it seized me, why he seized me, when I first read The Revolt as a teenager, why it changed my life, why I want to share a bit about it with all of you. And reading Begin's book is even more important today because it has suddenly, and most unfortunately, become so much more relevant in our own time. As Avi mentioned, I'd originally planned to begin our book discussions with a much lighter work, Maria Johnson's beautiful book, Strangers and Neighbors. But it seems we must begin with Begin, with the book's full statement and expression of the Begin doctrine, because it seems we need to learn once again the lessons of the Begin doctrine, the lessons found in this book, the lessons that dovetail with what Begin communicated in 1981 to his American guests, lessons which include, if an enemy of our people says he seeks to destroy us, believe him, lessons which include the necessity of the fighting Jew. Considering all that has occurred in the past week and a half, Menachem Begin's concluding words to these American visitors about the Holocaust and about Israel is particularly painful. After reflecting on the lessons of the Shoah, Begin then said the following: "We have come full circle, and with God's help, with the rebirth of sovereign Israel, we have finally broken the historic cycle. No more destruction, and no more defeats, and no more oppression. Only Jewish liberty with dignity and honor. These, I believe," said Begin, "are the underlying lessons to be learned from the unspeakable tragedy of the Holocaust." This is what Begin said, ladies and gentlemen, but of course, the images that we have experienced this past week were images that brought the Holocaust to mind, images that the State of Israel existed to ensure should never actually occur again. Jews mowed down by machine guns, as by the Einsatzgruppen, Jewish children murdered, Jewish bodies not only maimed but burned. And we turn, therefore, this evening back to Begin's book for instruction and inspiration in this difficult time. Tonight I will highlight several important themes at the heart of the work that is the revolt, themes that directly parallel or are rooted in the principles that Begin communicated to his guests in 1981, themes that are directly related to the moment in which we find ourselves. The first theme of the revolt is exactly what Begin said to his guests. The world may not necessarily like the fighting Jew, but the world will have to take account of him. These words said by Begin in 1981 are the central theme of the revolt launched in 1944, as well as the central theme of the book that Begin wrote about that revolt. This is one of the first paragraphs in this book. He writes, "I have written this book also for Gentiles, lest they be unwilling to realize, or all too ready to overlook, the fact that out of blood and fire and tears and ashes, a new specimen of human being was born, a specimen completely unknown to the world for over 1,800 years, the fighting Jew. That Jew, whom the world considered dead and buried, never to rise again, has arisen. For he has learned that simple truth of life and death, and he will never again go down to the sides of the pit and vanish from off the earth." This is the central theme of Begin's life, the fighting Jew. The fighting Jew is necessary because of what Begin also said to the Americans. "If an enemy of our people says he seeks to destroy us, believe him. Don't doubt him for a moment." And there are, ladies and gentlemen, always enemies of our people that say that. Begin noted in the book that in the past, no one, or most, not even at a certain point, many, if not most, and not even all of those most affected by it, were willing to come to terms with the fact that when the Nazis proclaimed their dedication to Jewish destruction, they meant it. As he writes in the book, quote, "Many Jews, too, treated these reports with skepticism, and no wonder. It is difficult for a normal human being to believe that his parents or his children or his brothers and sisters have been wiped out just like that." And he adds, "Was it possible," they asked themselves, "to wipe out a whole people? And in the 20th century, what would the world say?" And Begin adds, "They did not realize that it was precisely the spirit and scientific advancement of the 20th century that made the destruction of a whole people possible. And furthermore, that as it was the Jewish people, the world would remain largely unmoved." Begin's point is that even as the Nazis rose from the early 1930s, much of the Jewish world did not fully grasp the terrible emergency. And some could not even believe it, even as it was happening. The mainstream Zionist world would not rebel against the British even when the greatest of indignities occurred, the constant British capitulation to the Mufti of Jerusalem and to those seeking to curtail Jewish emigration to the Holy Land. And the less the Jewish people and the Zionist movement fought back, the easier it was for the British in the 30s to violate its promise to the Jewish people, and the easier it was for the quote-unquote civilized world to allow the horror to go forward. Thus Begin further writes, "Dark night, the darkest of all nights, descended on the Jewish people in Europe. 1,500,000 Jewish children were transported to the death trains, to the in the death trains to the gas chambers. Millions of men and women were shot or drowned or burned or gassed or burned alive. When man becomes a beast, Begin wrote, the Jew ceases to be regarded as a human being. There is no room here for self-delusion. It was not only the Nazis and their friends who regarded the Jews as germs to be destroyed. The whole world, which calls itself enlightened, began to get used to the idea that perhaps the Jew is not as other human beings. And then Begin added the following, again striking the theme, as he does throughout the book again and again. The world does not pity the slaughtered. It only respects those who fight. For better or for worse, that is the truth. We Jews always have enemies, and therefore we always need the fighting Jew. Thus, Begin adds, in the revolt, a new generation grew up which turned its back on fear. It began to fight instead of to plead. For nearly 2,000 years, the Jews as Jews had not borne arms, and it was on this complete disarmament, as much psychological as physical, that our oppressors calculated. They did not realize that the two phenomena were interdependent. We gave up our arms when we were exiled from our country. With our return to the land of our fathers, our strength was restored. Thus Begin concludes one of his chapters with the following. When Descartes said, I think, therefore I am, he uttered a very profound thought. But there are times in the history of peoples when thought alone does not prove their existence. There are times, Begin writes and adds, when everything in you cries out, your very self-respect as human being lies in your resistance to evil. We fight, therefore we are. We fight, therefore we are. This is the first theme of the book titled The Revolt, the necessity of the rise of the fighting Jew. And it is with this theme with which the book begins, describing how Begin was released from Soviet prison to serve in the Polish army, how he made his way to the Holy Land, where the followers of Zev Jabotinsky in British Mandate Palestine turned to Begin, who had led Jabotinsky's Beitar organization of Poland, asking him to lead their underground army in the Holy Land. While this army had ceased activity for much of the war, unlike the smaller group known as Lehi or Lochamei Chirut Yisrael, in 1944, with Nazi Germany now seen as weakened, the organization of Jabotinsky's followers, known as the Irgun or Etzel, Irgun Tzvai Leumi, the National Military Organization, was prepared to launch a revolt against what was then still the largest empire on earth. And in Begin's eyes, the revolt was justified first and foremost because of the way Britain had violated its promises and allowed Jews to stay in Europe and die as the English closed the gates to Eretz Yisrael. Or as Begin writes, two predominating facts determined the condition of the Jewish people at the height of the Second World War. Hitler was exterminating millions of Jews in Europe, and in spite of this, Britain continued to keep the gates of the Jewish national home tightly shut against the Jews. So he writes, and indeed Begin further argues that for much of the British establishment, the death of the Jews in the camps, he believes, was not looked at adversely because, he argues, it quote-unquote solved the conundrum that concerned them, how to allow an Arab majority to dominate the Holy Land while still claiming that Britain had lived up to its promise of offering the Jews a home under the mandate. Thus, in 1944, the revolt was announced on Irgun posters that were placed all over the Holy Land. And it read, 4 years have passed since the war began, and all the hopes that beat in your hearts then have evaporated without a trace. We have not been accorded international status. No Jewish army has been set up. The gates of the country have not been opened. The British regime has sealed its shameful betrayal of the Jewish people, and there is no moral basis whatsoever for its presence in Eretz Israel. We shall fearlessly draw conclusions. There is no longer any armistice between the Jewish people and the British administration in Eretz Israel, which hands our brothers over to Hitler. Our people is at war with this regime, war to the end. With this, Begin became the most wanted person in the British Mandate, though he was never caught, becoming a master of disguise, taking on the identity of a very Orthodox Jew, Yisrael Halperin, complete with beard and a black hat, which necessitated him to take on the persona of somebody without a job who hung around in the shul, helping them make a minyan. Yehuda Avner reports in his own memoir that once Begin came to his home and saw the Irgun waiting for a meeting to plan for an operation. And they said, oh, Menachem, we're glad you're here. We need to plan this operation. And Begin said, I can't right now. I have to go to mincha. I have to go to afternoon services. Then he went to the services, and then with his cover maintained, he returned to help plan the operation. But when he wasn't doing mincha, he was actually overseeing raids on British bases, arms storages, and government facilities, and eventually much bigger targets, all described in the book. Today, if you wish to understand the stunning success of the revolt, I mean the actual revolt, not the book, I would recommend reading the book, The Revolt, side by side with a very different, much more modern work, Anonymous Soldiers, by Bruce Hoffman. Hoffman's book, lauded by both right and left for its painstaking research, essentially argues that it was the Irgun's operations against the British after World War II that was a central, perhaps the primary reason that the British abandoned Mandate Palestine and partition came into being. Hoffman's book is all the more interesting because he did not write the book from the perspective of, say, Mayor Soloveitchik. Unlike me, this book, he doesn't love Menachem Begin. Unlike me, Menachem Begin is not his hero. The book doesn't celebrate Menachem Begin. He thinks Menachem Begin was a terrorist. But rather, he seeks to show in the book how Begin's strategy against Britain was of immense historical significance. His thesis, based on his extensive study of British records, is that it was the Irgun's unremitting attacks on the British over especially the 2 years before the birth of Israel that drove the government of Clement Attlee to ultimately turn over the issue of the future of the Holy Land to the United Nations. And that ensured that the UN partition proposal in 1947 would go forward. As late as the first part of 1946, British Foreign Minister Ernest Bevin had been convinced that Britain could continue to control the Holy Land. As Hoffman writes, Bevin had, quote, forcefully argued that Britain's stature as a great power was inextricably linked to the maintenance of its Middle Eastern strategic and economic interests. And he adds, his position accorded completely with that of the Chiefs of Staff. But, Hoffman tells us, that after the unremitting attacks of the Irgun, Britain ultimately announced that it would allow the United Nations to propose a solution to what was called the Palestine problem. And there, thus the stage was set for the visit to the Holy Land of UNSCOP, the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine. And when they arrived in the Holy Land in June of 1947, what they found, as Hoffman describes, was a state in which one hand ruled with martial law, while the other hand had just discovered that despite the constant crackdowns, despite the enormous amount of British troops in Palestine, His Majesty's government couldn't even protect the most heavily fortified prison in the land of Israel from the hands of the Irgun. Because it was precisely at that point that Menachem Begin launched his most famous operation, one made famous in the movie Exodus, the assault and the freeing of prisoners from the British prison in Akko. The conclusion one draws from Hoffman's book is that even though it was Ben-Gurion that oversaw the birth of the Jewish state and was therefore the central figure in the story of Israel's rise and in the War of Independence, it was Begin that was central to the British leaving in the first place. It's very striking that when Hoffman's book was first reviewed in the New York Times by the historian Tom Segev, who I can guarantee you, ladies and gentlemen, is anything but a Begin lover, he does seem to give real respect to Hoffman's thesis. But his criticism of it is to say that he believes some credit should be given to the Haganah as well. As Tom Segev put it in a paragraph that I enjoyed, quote, notwithstanding, this is about Hoffman's book, notwithstanding his carefully formulated conclusions, one can hardly avoid the impression his book gives that Begin defeated the British Empire single-handedly. That is also, he writes, the impression Begin conveys in his memoir, The Revolt. In reality, Tom Segev writes, the Irgun was only part of the violent struggle against the British. A major role was played by the Haganah, which acted under the political responsibility of David Ben-Gurion, later Israel's prime minister. So that's where he writes, and you know a book has made its mark when Tom Segev is forced to say, the Haganah also did something in order to get the British out of Mandate Palestine. But the truth is, ladies and gentlemen, that while, of course, the Haganah and Ben-Gurion is actually not just central, but most central in the story of the declaration of Israel's independence, the preparation of the and formation of the IDF, and the winning of the war, the Haganah only briefly joined the assaults on the British before 1948, though it did join long enough for its leadership to approve the bombing of the King David Hotel, which Ben-Gurion then blamed on Begin as if his own group had nothing to do with it. Hoffman, again not pro-Begin, confirms the thesis of the revolt in his own book, which is that the world only was galvanized to pressure Britain to leave, to open the gates of the Holy Land to the survivors of the Holy Land, when what Begin calls the fighting Jew made it unbearable for the British to be there. Therefore, when it comes to the birth of the Jewish state, as well as, of course, the war that followed, it is truly the case that Israelis can say with Begin, "We fight, therefore we are." This is the first theme of the revolt. The second theme of the book is the metaphysical bonds joining every Jew together. This is the bond that Begin expressed when he told his American visitors in 1981, "When a Jew is threatened, do everything in your power to help him." But for Begin, this was a code by which he lived his life. And in fact, Begin not only believed that when a Jew is threatened, you should do everything in your power to help him, but he also believed that you shouldn't hurt Jews, even when those Jews are trying to hurt you. This can be seen, of course, in the famous story of the Altalena, when Ben-Gurion fired on the Irgun ship and Begin ordered his men not to fire back. But it could be seen even more memorably in the 1944 period known as the Saison, described in the revolt, when Ben-Gurion's Haganah participated with the British in the rounding up and the torture of Irgun fighters. At this point, Ben-Gurion was not able to say that he was leading an independent state. He was one of several rival factions, albeit the largest. And therefore, one might expect, especially here, that the Irgun, as they were being rounded up, would fight back, take revenge on Ben-Gurion and the Haganah. As I note in my own book, even the most ardent admirers of Ben-Gurion, like the historian Anita Shapira, write with some understatement that this was not, quote-unquote, his finest moment, while noting that Ben-Gurion still never, as she writes, expressed regret for his actions. But Begin ordered that there were to be no reprisals, referring back to the fall of Second Temple Jerusalem, in which civil war suffused the city. This passage is perhaps the most moving in the revolt, where he explained why the Irgun soldiers, despite every fiber of their being crying out for revenge, would not take revenge. He writes, "We dared not destroy our faith by opening a bloody abyss between those who were still brothers and might yet become comrades in arms. We saw our people in Europe in the endless procession of death. We saw the ghettos going up in flames. We saw the oppressor plotting against us all. And from down the corridors of history, we heard the echo of those other wars, the cursed internecine wars in dying Jerusalem 19 centuries before. The underground cellar," writes Begin, "is a high watchtower. Not logic, but instinct said imperatively, no, not civil war, not that at any price. And who knows, perhaps instinct is the very heart of logic." Begin argues in the book that it was not his order that actually resulted in the Irgun staying its hand against their fellow Jews. He writes, "The order came from somewhere, from the depths of Jewish history, and it was obeyed. Jewish unity above all else, never a civil war." That is what Begin stressed in the Saison and the Altalena episode. That theme is also throughout this book. It is the second theme of the revolt. And the third theme follows from the second. And it sets this military memoir apart, I think, from probably all others. This may be the only memoir of a military movement that devotes as much time to the simple soldiers that served under him, as much space to the men lower down on the hierarchy as the commanders. Perhaps even more space is devoted to the simple soldiers. There are around three chapters that discuss the story of Dov Gruner, a Jew who fled Hungary ahead of the Holocaust, served in the British Army in the war, and then joined the Irgun's rebellion. Dov Gruner was captured in an Irgun raid on a Ramat Gan police station, and he was sentenced to death. An international campaign was waged for clemency, given his wartime service to the UK, but the British, in an act that horrified even Begin's opponents, hung Dov Gruner in the middle of the night in the Akko prison gallows, denying him the right to see a rabbi before he was hanged. Begin describes how prior to his hanging, Dov Gruner wrote a letter to Begin. "And when I traveled to Israel with a group of Tikva supporters, we went to the Akko prison and stood in the gallows room where Dov Gruner was hung. And I took there into that room my own copy of the book, The Revolt, a copy that is signed by Menachem Begin. I don't have it here because I don't take it out of the house usually. It's raining outside in New York. I don't take that book. I try not to take that book anywhere because it's so precious to me. But I took it with me all the way to Israel because I wanted to stand in those gallows where Dov Gruner was hung, and I wanted Begin's presence there with me. And so there, with my friends, with Tikva supporters, I stood and I read Dov Gruner's letter to Begin. And as Begin describes in the book, Gruner wrote, "Of course I want to live. Who does not? But I am sorry, but if I am sorry that I am about to finish, meaning die, it is mainly because I did not manage to do enough. I too could have let the future fend for itself, taken the job I was promised, or left the country altogether and lived securely in America. But that would not have given me satisfaction as a Jew, and certainly not as a Zionist." Menachem Begin went out of his way to mention Dov Gruner in his speech following the departure of the British, following the victory of the revolt, a speech with which the book ends. He gives him credit in the speech for the revolt success, along with the commanders, and he credits him for their achievement along with the fathers of Zionism, Herzl and Jabotinsky. Dov Gruner was a boy who commanded no army, led no political movement. But Begin, who apparently seems to have come close to an emotional breakdown when Gruner was hung, was bound to this boy, heart and soul, just as he was bound to all those who served under him. And at the end of this book, he explains why he talks so much about these soldiers. Begin writes, "It is right that every act performed for the liberation of our people should be recorded and remembered. It is right that everybody who worked in one way or another for the creation of reborn Hebrew strength and for its application in the struggle for liberation should be singled out and remembered. In what we call history," Begin wrote, "there is considerable injustice. History, especially the chronicles of war and revolt, records the names of a few who stood at the head. But the truth is that often the main work is done by the craftsmen, the rank and file, the unknown soldiers. Let us not reconcile ourselves to this historic injustice. The chronicles of the Jewish struggle for liberation should be written in their entirety." This is what Begin wrote. And so there, in Begin's spirit and in the spirit of all that he stood for, we listened to Begin. We remembered the unknown soldiers. We stood in the gallows chamber. We read Dov Gruner's letter aloud from the copy of the revolt signed by Menachem Begin's own hand. And we recited the Kaddish. Where Dov Gruner had died, we allowed his memory to live. And we were not the only one to remember him. Because as I mentioned in my Jerusalem 365 series, the writer Stephen Pressfield records an interview with one of the IDF commanders that was present at the Temple Mount and the Western Wall in 1967. And that commander, in an interview, describes the simple soldier that he had chosen to be the first soldier at the Western Wall, several hours, I believe, before the famous three soldiers of the photograph arrived there. He said, "I picked a young sergeant named Dov Gruner. This Dov Gruner was not the first to bear this name. Dov Gruner," he adds, "was hanged at the Akko prison in April 16, 1947. As it happened, his brother's wife had recently given birth to a son whom they had named Dov. This boy grew to be our Dov." So a boy named after the Dov Gruner remembered by Begin, Dov Gruner's nephew, a boy named Dov Gruner was the first soldier in 67 at the Western Wall. Begin's spirit lived then too. Every soldier matters. These then are the themes of the revolt, of the book that means so much to me. They are, again, when an enemy tells you he wants to kill Jews, believe him. The world may not like the fighting Jew, but it cannot discount the fighting Jew. The Jewish people are one, and that is why when a Jew is threatened, we must do everything we can to save him or her. And finally, we must remember every single hero. All these themes, ladies and gentlemen, are suddenly more relevant than I could have ever imagined 2 weeks ago. Let us then face this difficult period with Begin's wisdom. We turn first and foremost in looking at what was overlooked, in looking what we must realize again now. And that is, again, if an enemy of our people says he seeks to destroy us, believe him. As I described in my article in the Wall Street Journal on Friday, Hamas's charter explicitly calls for the genocide of the Jewish people. And yet, for years, this ironclad rule was not applied to them. In a striking series of tweets, or whatever we call them now, X's or something, tabloid journalist Armin Rosen, who has visited and reported from Gaza, reflected this past week on the mistake that everyone made. As he put it, quote, "The widely held conventional wisdom in both Washington and Jerusalem was that Hamas was strongly ideological, but inevitably pragmatic, and cared about retaining its infrastructure and domain in Gaza more than it cared about killing Jews." The Israeli security establishment, Armin adds, viewed Hamas rockets as a tactical threat, far more mild than the strategic level threat looming in the north. And Hamas was an address, a phone number they could call. The IDF, he writes, had to coordinate with Hamas on a daily basis. Armin further writes that in Washington, Hamas was viewed as a not unreasonable extension of a movement that respectable opinion viewed as inherently democratizing and even quasi-liberal. Armin Rosen reflects that he made this mistake, writing, "People like me, meanwhile, went to the Gaza Strip, spent a couple days looking around, interviewed people, and decided, these guys are awful, but maybe they're not psychopaths." But this, Armin realizes, was wrong. He writes how every way in which the situation was treated reflected this assumption. He writes, "The Strip got its electricity from Israel, meaning Hamas could stockpile generators, fuel, etc. for war. In recent months, Gazans who got foreign visas were allowed to use the airport in a lot. All these policies were based on the idea this slaughter wouldn't or couldn't happen, but it did happen. The worst slaughter in Israel's history wasn't done by the Egyptian army or the Arab Legion or Hezbollah or ISIS or whatever. It was done by a group that 30 years of strategic thinkers across the entire Western Bloc had more or less koshered." End quote. And so again and again and again, if an enemy of our people says he seeks to destroy us, believe him. Don't doubt him for a moment. Don't make light of it. Do all in your power to deny him the means of carrying out a satanic intent, which means, of course, that we must apply Begin's principle not only to Hamas and not only to Hezbollah, but of course to their masters in Iran. And that is an issue facing Israel and the Jewish world, no matter what ultimately happens in Gaza. Now, after this terrible week and a half, the Jewish people must unite in order to make good on what Begin further taught us. When a Jew anywhere is threatened or under attack, do all in your power to come to his aid. Never pause to wonder what the world will think or say. The world may not necessarily like the fighting Jew, but the world will have to take account of him. The fighting Jews are coming forward. And in the spirit of Begin's statement, in the spirit of Begin's worldview, Jews are uniting and coming together. Just 2 weeks ago, we saw how in Tel Aviv, residents were clashing over a traditional service in the streets. On Yom Kippur, we saw Israelis yelling at fellow Tel Avivians for coming to a traditional service, for people who came for a little bit of tradition. Now, 2 weeks after those fights between Jew and Jew, one suddenly reads stories in Tel Aviv like this. This is a headline today in the Times of Israel. It reads, "In order to cook for tens of thousands, Tel Aviv restaurants kosher their kitchens." And the headline continues, "At least 100 restaurants in Tel Aviv combine forces to cook nourishing food for soldiers, hospitalized patients, and evacuees from south, along with similar effort elsewhere." So in other words, you have tens and tens of non-kosher kitchens all over the city hurrying to perform a koshering procedure, an emergency koshering procedure, which is not easy, just in order to feed the soldiers and those in need. This is just one of countless stories, one of so many stories from every aspect, every part of the Jewish community across Israel. There will, ladies and gentlemen, come times of division again, as there isn't any vibrant democracy, but we must remember this moment. I often quote the story told by Natan Sharansky about how when he was talking to his neighbor in Israel, his neighbor was remembering wistfully the spirit of Jewish unity during the Soviet Jewry movement. And she said to Natan, it was so great when you were in prison. We had these twin bar mitzvahs. We would go to the rallies. Where did it all go? And Natan Sharansky said, "I'm sorry, but I'm not going to be going back to prison. The Jews will have to find another reason to love one another." Well, we have, and we must remember. And finally, and very importantly for our moment, a uniquely Begin-esque lesson. We must remember every hero in this story, for there are so many. There have already been countless reports of those that fought against the terrorists when they attacked, of those that sought to save as many as they could, as well as descriptions of the many soldiers that then arrived in defense of their brethren. We read of those that died defending others, of those that fell on grenades thrown by Hamas in order to shield their comrades, of medics who insisted on staying to tend to the wounded and then were murdered by terrorists that further arrived. There are so many heroes. Every single one of them must be remembered, everyone admired, everyone celebrated, everyone commemorated, everyone marked, everyone having us pray about him or her, Hashem Yikom Damo, Hashem Yikom Dama. May God avenge his blood. May God avenge her blood. What Begin said about the revolt is true about the heroes of the Simchat Torah War, the heroes that fought back at the beginning of the Simchat Torah War, and the heroes that are to follow. History, especially the chronicles of war and revolt, records the names of a few who stood at the head. But the truth is that often the main work is done by the rank and file. The chronicles of the Jewish struggle for liberation, as Begin wrote, should be written in their entirety. This spirit, the spirit of this passage with which Begin concludes his book, revealed itself in a video that I saw, a speech delivered by a commander of Battalion 13 of the Golani Brigade, the brigade which has thus far suffered the most losses. The commander was speaking to his troops, and this is from the Hebrew, a translation of by the journalist Chaviv Redigur. The commander said, "Chevra, Battalion 13 are heroes, but this is only the beginning. We have more nights of defense and a maneuver operation still ahead." And then the battalion commander, knowing that there is a phrase in Hebrew, Dor Yom HaKippurim, the Yom Kippur generation, referring to those who were forged heroically in the fire of the surprise attack of the Yom Kippur War. This commander then said to his troops, right now, this past week, Tiru Dor Yom HaKippurim, Echad V'Echad. Look at this Yom Kippur generation, each of you. In 10 years, said this commander, in 10 years, there will be a commander of the 13th Battalion with hero warriors. Some of you, he said, will already be parents. And, this commander said, the commander of the Battalion 13 at that time, he says, will mobilize the battalion on Yom Kippur and tell them about you and show pictures of our dead. It's very striking because when I saw it, I realized that this commander, whose name I believe was Tomer Greenberg, was echoing unintentionally the famous battlefield speech at Agincourt given by Henry V, where he talks about that one day you will look back on the anniversary of this battle and you will talk about what occurred there. But unlike Henry in Shakespeare, who talks about how each one will stand and boast of his own accomplishments, then will he strip his sleeves and show his scars and say, "These wounds I earned on Crispin's Day." The commander speaks to each one of them about how his comrades will remember them, how they each were bound to another, how the contribution of each and every hero, each and every soldier, will be remembered, because in history there's a great injustice. We speak only of the leaders, but we must remember every single soldier. And then this commander said to his soldiers, "It turns out you're not so pampered. You're no less heroes than in the past. That you're not the Dor HaIphone, the iPhone generation. All honor to you. Proud of everyone standing here." And then he concluded, "This is just the beginning." This is, ladies and gentlemen, indeed just the beginning. Difficult sacrifices for Israel are yet to come. And as for us here in the Golah, the diaspora, you must be prepared. You will hear all sorts of criticisms of the Jewish state, constant calumnies, a series of lies. And you will hear, even from those offering sympathies to the Jewish people, you will hear often the same tired cliches. You will hear phrases like two-state solution. You will hear occupation. You will hear cycle of violence. You will hear all sorts of things, all the same tired cliches. And when your co-worker or your neighbor or those you debate put forward these points, you will try to explain again and again the same points. Israel withdrew from Gaza. Hamas was elected in Gaza. Hamas constantly fired rockets into Gaza. It maintained its dedication to opposing peace and to murdering as many Jews as possible. These points are important, and we must continue to make them, and we must continue to support Israel. And these points should be emphasized. But in the end, the Begin doctrine set forward in the revolt remains the same. What will most defend the Jewish people is victory over our enemies, because the world, as Begin said, will not necessarily love the fighting Jew, but it will take note of him. This is indeed just the beginning, and the fighting Jew is about to make himself and herself known again. I came upon in the records online of the Menachem Begin Heritage Center a statement by Begin, which is not, I believe, found in the revolt, but is a summary of it, a succinct summation of the worldview of the man who made peace with Israel's greatest enemy, and almost immediately after that struck Osirak, showing the Jewish people that being the peacemaker went hand in hand with, when necessary, being the fighting Jew. The quote from Begin explains this. It is a summation of the revolt, a summation of what it means to be the fighting Jew, a summation of all that must be on our minds and in our mouths, in our hearts and souls at this difficult time. This is what Menachem Begin said. The fighting Jew is a human being. He is the son of a Jewish mother, that most marvelous of all God's creatures, with all the softness of her love and the heavy burden of her concern. The fighting Jew loves children, all children, Arab children too, I assure you. The fighting Jew loves books, loves liberty, and hates war like Garibaldi, but he is prepared to fight for liberty. The fighting Jew does not want to harm any Arab. He wants peace between us and all Arabs. But, Begin continued, if you ever raise a hand against his people, know this, meaning the people of the fighting Jew, know this, the fighting Jew is fearless. His heart is of steel. His hands are trained for war and his fingers for battle. He will strike the enemy, disperse him, repulse him, and destroy him, and ensure that his people shall have life, freedom, and human respect in the land of its fathers for all eternity. So Begin said, to which I say, Kein yihi ratzon, so may we see it speedily in our days. Thank you very much.